Homeless Coordinating Board monthly meeting. Thank you so much. We have a pretty packed agenda this morning. We actually got 80 minutes of programming, so we're gonna at least this time ask Charles, our timekeeper, to pretty precise about regulating our speaking time. Because we want to get through this, and we want to give the public plenty of time to make comments and questions. So with that, we will go to our agenda. One thing about after every agenda item, you'll have 2 minutes to publicly speak about that particular item. At the end of our meeting, you'll have a chance to speak 2 minutes about anything in general on or off the agenda. So with that, we'll introduce our minutes from May 1 meeting. And we'll go over that and see if we have any comments about that. Okay, with that, any board members have anything to discuss? Minutes?
I move to approve.
I'll second.
Okay, we all vote?
Aye.
Aye. Anybody opposed? Okay, the minutes will be accepted. As generally, we'll go to the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing. Mr. Kaczynski, are you going to take the sample?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you, board members. Sam Dodge, Deputy Director of Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing. Happy to give an update. This has been a very big month, this last month, for the department and the COC and the work we've been doing. There's going to be some great updates that will be given by colleagues later in the agenda, so I will stay away from those items and really say that the One system, our new data system, is live and has started to be rolled out with the homeless outreach team. And that's a very exciting step for us, and it took quite a lot to get here, and just really want to appreciate all those that have worked on it, especially local homeless coordinating board and Megan Owens and others in the programs, and the outreach workers themselves that are really getting the kinks worked out of this system as it's live. We made a really important announcement this last month, which has been a long time coming, which is the Tipping Point Community Foundation has agreed to spearhead this campaign of raising $100 million to address chronic homelessness in San Francisco's community. And I think maybe some things get lost in the media around that I wanted to highlight. And one is that they've been involved with us already in our moving home program and helping to fund Brilliant Corners and their housing locator functions to take advantage of some vouchers that were being underutilized in our housing authority to offer a step out of supportive housing for those families and individuals that are ready for that. And that's been an important collaboration. There's also they provided some seed fund capital funding to expedite the opening of the expansion of the respite beds in the DPH program there on Mission Street. And something that got kind of lost in that is that Supervisor Jane Kim has really been a champion of expanding those services. She had the experience of going into our shelter system and staying there. And one of the things that really struck her was the age and acuity of people that are utilizing our shelter system and the real need for expanding nurses in our shelter system and expanding the respite bed program for those whose, you know, acuity raises above what can be competently delivered in the shelter setting. And so really want to thank her for her longstanding leadership and, you know, supporting that program expansion along with the final $600,000 that Tipping Point contributed to that effort. So the $100 million, it should just be really clear that the Tipping Point's board is the final decision maker about how those funds get expended. They've been a good partner so far and have been very curious to know what we're doing and how we're going and how they can be helpful. So we'll see how that goes. And this really goes on top of our work with Heading Home campaign with Hamilton Family, and they're raising extra funds for rapid rehousing for families, which has a target of $30 million, and some other donations from the philanthropic community around expanding navigation centers. So it's been nice to see this kind of support for our work. We also celebrated the announcement of the National Hotel, which was part of a bonus project that was run in the COC process, not this year, but the previous year, when there were bonus projects on the table from the federal government. And this had a strong, which is how we were able to open the Baldwin House Hotel on 6th Street, if you guys know that. It's a large supportive housing for chronically homeless. And this was this one was another bonus project that was three hotels, the Winton, the National, and the Crown. And the Winton and the National is what we were celebrating opening, and it's 198 units combined between the Winton and the National. And they're both addressing chronic homelessness. And at the Winton, they are also, some project-based bash vouchers. So there's quite a few veterans there. And we had a nice event, and it was nice to see all the work that has gone into that from the program staff and the COC and the local homeless coordinating board and the veterans, all the myriad of groups working on the veterans initiative, to really see, to be able to celebrate all those people coming home. And I want to also say that in this past month, we had a robust hearing at the Board of Supervisors around youth homelessness. And there was a great turnout of our providers, of parallel departments that have a role to play when it comes to youth homelessness, whether it's the Human Services Agency or DPH or the Children's Youth and Families Council. The supervisor, Jeff Sheehy, called for the hearing, very interested in seeing what more can be done around youth homelessness. A big subject of the hearing that we were bringing was the youth demonstration project, which we were one of 10 cities that was selected to deliver from the federal government about innovations on youth homelessness. And this is part of an ongoing program that has a lot of community process and consumer participation that should have a plan coming out later this summer. Another great ribbon cutting we had this month was the Central Waterfront Navigation Center. This is at 25th and Michigan in the Port-owned property near the Dog Patch neighborhood. It's a 64-unit navigation center. This was done in conjunction over this past year with the port and their amazing staff and their board, especially their board president, Willie Adams, who's been a really strong supporter. And that was a very difficult process, or just a long process to go through the port's process. Some great help from the planning department, some great help, of course, from our partners at Public Works and their architecture team. It's a beautiful, real creative, beautifully constructed navigation center. We had to vacate a street. There's used trailers in a very creative way. It's a very welcoming, nice spot. Then Episcopal Community Services and Providence Foundation are the operators there, and they've done a really great job. And they've opened it up, and they've started to welcome clients in. And tomorrow night, there'll be a community open house there at the Central Waterfront Navigation Center, and it's going to be great. I just want to really thank the staff and the supervisor, Cohen, for her great work with us to get this open and to work with the community and the Dogpatch Neighborhood Association, the Dogpatch neighbors and businesses in general. There was a long road together, but I think we ended up in a really good place. And so it was nice to see that finally open. There's been a lot of activity at the state level. Over 100 bills around housing and homelessness have been introduced. We've been working closely with Assemblymember Phil Ting on AB 932. This is to expand some of the work around a shelter crisis declaration and to help eliminate some state obstacles to siting and opening shelters, drop-in centers, homeless services, and permanent supportive housing, and to really kind of address situations that we find here in San Francisco, but also partner communities find. So LA and Oakland have signed on to this, along with some other communities, and it made it out of the assembly, and it's making its way. But this is only one of many bills. Our other assemblyman, David Chu, has had very active and successful bills on housing for a healthy California, which would match housing vouchers to the whole person care Medi-Cal waiver, which is important. New resources to approach medically complicated people that are also experiencing homelessness. And we feel like that's a really important part of the service plan, because Medi-Cal dollars can pay for the kind of social work and those kind of things, but we need some partner dollars to pay for the housing, which is very important. They also, David Chu got out of the assembly an important bill around second home mortgages and removing them from the state tax credits and taking that cost savings and putting it towards permanent affordable housing. And there's a $3 billion housing bond coming out of the Senate. There's a fee increase for real estate transactions. They will also put money for permanent supportive housing. So all of this is kind of happening, and we will see in the end. They kind of have these vote-aroundas right now, a lot of bills coming out, and then they kind of deal with them together as a package.
Can you wrap up about 2 minutes?
Yes, I can. I want to take 1 second to review with you the president's budget proposals with when it comes to homelessness, and just say in the HUD budget he's promoting eliminating the community development block grants, which is $3 billion, which often goes to homeless services. Total elimination of the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness. Hundreds of millions of dollars for homeless assistance grants, for mainstream 811 vouchers, which are for seniors, and $974 million annual cut to the tenants-based rental assistance. So those are just the homeless programs in HUD, but in HHS programs and other programs in the federal budget, including emergency food and shelter programs in the Homeland Security budget and others, there's billions of cuts. There's small increases in the VA to continue their work, although the VA...
Excuse me just a minute. Could someone give the mother and the kids a place to sit down? Maybe move over a little bit so she can... Thank you, guys. I'm sorry, Sam.
No, that's all right. And so it's just very important and sobering just to remember that, you know, we need to have an active role on kind of all levels. Otherwise, we're backfilling bigger holes as we kind of move forward with these creative and new endeavors. I'll say the one last thing, and I'll finish up, that the homeless point in time count is a biennial count that every community has to conduct. Our point in time count was conducted in just this last January with record participation. It looks like we'll be able to release that sometime in June, mid-June, which we look forward to doing. Our partner communities have started to release their data. and, you know, including Oakland, Alameda, is increased of 39%, Seattle, an increase of over 20%, and LA, an increase of 23%. These are all coming off of large base numbers. There's really no good pick count number. If it goes down by margins, it's still meaning thousands of people at any one time are experiencing extreme deprivation and homelessness. So, you know, it's a sobering reminder of the kind of work we have left to do. You know, when we get a firm date and when we're able to release our numbers, I'll make sure that the entire board and the public will use our list too. We'll know exactly when and where we'll release. So thank you.
Thank you, Sam. And, you know, I encourage anyone to go by and visit that Navigation Center. It's tomorrow night, the community open house. Mm-hmm.
Six to seven.
The words that were said at that grand opening, amazing, beautiful, awesome. You wouldn't think that would be describing a facility for people without homes. But it is fabulous. It's a fabulous place. And your department did a very good job coordinating that. We hope to see more of those.
Okay.
That's what we really hope to see. So any other questions? Any questions from the board members or comments?
Sam, quick
question. Yes.
Do we know if Tipping Point is going to release an RFP for that $100 million?
Do
you know their process for distributing the funds?
I don't know their exact process. I think they've been still mulling over some various ways to go forward. I think that they've expressed some strong preference for trying to develop housing in some way. And I don't think they've settled on exactly how each component, other than the overall goal of reducing chronic homelessness in our community by half in 5 years.
Board members, okay, we'll turn the comment and question section over to the general public. You'll have 2 minutes each to ask or make a comment to Sam Dodge.
Yeah, Sam, it seemed like you talked for about a half an hour. I'm looking for something written from your body, regarding all of this. There's several things. The problem that I'm having is what are you going to do about Proposition Q? The police are displacing people and not providing them housing, a clear violation of Proposition Q. The other issue is we're a navigation center, but it seems like you're breaking the law. You're not following the standards of care. You're violating the tuberculosis policy, the shelter grievance policy, the shelter extension policy, and you refuse to have the shelter monitoring committee inspect the navigation centers. So you talk about navigation centers, but you're breaking the law. And why? I mean, just why? And how many people have to sue the city and county of San Francisco regarding you breaking the law to actually get something done? I mean, and does this body have any desire to demand that they follow the tuberculosis policy, have the shelter monitoring committee inspect these places, or that they even have that they actually follow the San Francisco's grievance policy? It seems like the navigation centers refuse to even follow the shelter training manual. So when a person goes into the navigation center, they have less rights than if they were to go into a shelter. And on top of all of that, I'm wondering, what is their housing policy? Do they just dump people everywhere that they can't afford? Or what's your housing policy for how you house these people, how you house the homeless?
So why don't we let Mr. Dodge respond to that question, because you're 2 minutes up. Respond to that. And I know, also keep in mind, on the agenda this morning, we have a representative from the shelter monitoring grievance policy. So some of those questions she might be able to address also.
She refused to respond to my emails.
Well, she's here today.
Will she respond to me?
Yes, sir. Sam?
Thank you. So there's a lot packed in there. I think that one of the important parts was what is our housing policy from out of the navigation centers. And one of the important things that came out of kind of a community process with a legislation that passed last year was to have equitable entrance into housing. and to align kind of housing policies from navigation centers to coordinated entry. And so that's what's happened. And there's no follow-up questions. So right now, it looks like as we're welcoming people into 1950, they might be coming off of the streets and out of encampments. Around a third are meeting that kind of high bar that we have for coordinated entry with our COC programs, which is 13 years of your life where you have at least one episode of homelessness in them. And so, you know, as the kind of department gets a policy going for coordinated entry alignment with our single adult programs, hopefully that will open up more of an equitable entry into the master lease programs and the formerly DOT programs, and so they can be aligned as well and with a transparent, clear policy. You know, for everyone who's welcomed in, they are given the opportunities for to get a changes profile and to get, you know, a 90-day bed in shelter. And so that's an important important aspect of being able to kind of change your life and to be able to use what works for thousands of people each year, which is our general shelter program. We've not had one TB incident. Sometimes
you don't track it.
No more questions, Sam. We need to wrap up.
Yeah. So it's not been. It's not been. We do track it.
Sir, you have taken your 2 minutes.
We're not violating any law.
Well, I'll see you in court.
Great.
Thank you, sir.
You've subpoenaed me before.
Any other comments or questions from the public?
Hi, my name is Will Daly. I'm a shelter client advocate. I wanted to speak to you about the grievance policy and the navigation center. The navigation centers are shelters, as defined by the mayor and his budget, as defined by HUD, as defined by the ordinance that set up the standards of care and the shelter monitoring committee. So you can't have a double standard in the shelter system. You can't say that the people who live in tents don't have the right to a grievance policy, and the people who don't live in tents that go into regular shelter do. It's a double standard, and it doesn't make any sense on any level. And this body, the Shelter Grievance Advisory Committee, which we'll be speaking about shortly, unanimously recommended that the grievance policy be brought into the navigation centers. So and people will tell you, oh, it's a different sort of program. Well, the winter shelters were, for years, they told us that was a different sort of program, and they relented, and they let us have the grievance policy in there. So by setting this up this way, you're creating a double standard. It's completely unfair. I think it could violate the Equal Protection Amendment of the Constitution. So I highly encourage you to do it. I'm tired of working under a two-tiered system where some shelter residents have rights and others. So I am going to resign over this, and I will go to the press, and I'll talk to everybody about it.
Thank you, sir.
I just say that there's not been a resistance to this. It's been a pretty new program.
Sam?
No, I'm not lying.
Sir, please don't speak out of place.
Sam.
Come on, ma'am. Thank you.
Hello, board members. Well, Sam, how's it going? I'm the founder and director of the St. Francis Homelessness Challenge. And I just wanted to give an update. I informed Jeff Kaczynski about this, but my organization was the one that was working with the Box City residents over at 7th, the encampment at 7th and Irwin to 16th. And we had asked for something different there, which was a coordinated interdepartmental effort. Instead of bringing everyone from Box City to the Navigation Center for 30 days and then going back, what if we could have some more on-site transition support services and actually coordinate with DPW and SFPD and the neighbors, which we were doing, and we were making gains. But you know, can't rewrite history. So what happened is that the Box City residents, the majority of them actually complied and went to the Navigation Center. And most of them were given an extension to stay until a 90-day shelter bed was ready, but most ended up not doing that. And the reason for that is that a lot of people feel that it's safer to be in a secure shelter on the street in an encampment with their peers rather than in a shelter. And but one person ended up going to the 90-day shelter at Sanctuary, and he started texting me late April to tell me all of the things that he was dealing with and his concerns and his fears. And he told me about his bunkmate who was growling and saying things to him, and he was frightened. Guess who his bunkmate turned out to be? Nicholas Flausch, the man who was shot on Market Street in the subway sandwich shop station by police for stabbing the person there. And so I talked and confirmed this with Sanctuary Shelter, and they actually told me that, yes, Nicholas Flausch was there. We had a memorial for him. And this just really illustrates the need for us to infuse lots of money, maybe from the tipping point money that's coming in, to transform Sanctuary, MSC South, all of these current shelters, to be real models for transition support. I worked in Portland, Oregon as AmeriCorps Vista in the early 20s. I worked for an organization called Transitions, Inc. They had an amazing program where you actually transitioned within the same building, where you started off in bunk beds, went to two to a room, and the top floor was one person to a room, and they were actually having a rental history. So I would love to see that money, some of it infused, so that people can actually feel that it's safer to go into the shelter program than it is to stay on the street. Thank you.
Thank you very much, ma'am. And I was out there that morning, and we broke up Box City. No one should have to live like that, ma'am. No one should have to live like that. The rats jumping out of those boxes and the garbage they took out of that, no one should have to live like that in this country or any other.
I agree, and that's why we need more organized shelter spaces and transitional villages, which my organization is working for. I look forward to talking to you more about that. I sent you an email today. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, ma'am. I'll respond to you. Next person.
Good morning, board members. Mr. Dodge. My name is Victoria Westbrook. I'm the director of programs for Code Tenderloin. And my question is simple. How do I get into the navigation centers to help the homeless become job ready and gain employment on their road to permanent housing?
So these are managed by community providers, Community Housing Partnership, and ECS and Mission Neighborhood Resource Center and Providence Foundation. The focus has been on kind of what the steps that are needed to take to get people into permanent affordable housing and not some of these other things like dentures or job attachment, but I think there has been more and more interest in kind of different kinds of things, and you know, so jobs may fit in there. So I'm happy to make some introductions if you
Thank you, ma'am. Are there any other questions? We will move on readily to the next agenda item.
So the next item up on the agenda is our report, a budget update from the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing.
You see it at the bottom?
While we're waiting, we have more handouts coming on that shelter grievance policies, the green sheet that some people have and some people don't. We'll have those pretty soon before the meeting is over.
Good morning, board members. I'm Marissa Pereira-Shelley. I'm the Fiscal and Performance Manager of the department, standing in for G.T. Whitley, who was unable to be here. So as you may know, the mayor submitted his proposed budget on Thursday, June 1st. And while in many city departments there was little or no growth, we saw some significant investments in homeless services. So I want to walk you through a little bit of what is in our proposed budget. So first off, very high level, the fiscal 18 budget is $246 million, fiscal 19, $241. And that decrease is because of some one-time capital funding in year one going away in year two. So this is a 13% increase off of our current year budget, an increase of $22 million in general fund support. I'm going to walk you through some of those key investments of those $22 million. Also includes some new federal grants and anticipated increases in our federal grants, and a 2.5% CBO COLA in each year. So I guess it's 2.5% next year, growing to 5% in the second year. So one area of key investment, as you've heard from our department over and over and over again, is coordinated entry and implementing coordinated entry. So this budget includes both federal and local funds to expand coordinated entry so that we can utilize more of our housing portfolio, and to implement family coordinated entry, which will include creating some in-person hubs for service connection. Next, there's also significant investments in additional navigation centers and shelter beds. So there's funding to increase the number of navigation center beds at 416 beds by the end of the next fiscal year. So we have funding to continue the 1950 mission until it cycles down, Civic Center Hotel, Central Waterfront, which just opened, 1515 South Van Ness, which is about to open, the Soma Trio Center about midway through next year, and then also funding to fund a to-be-determined site location after 1515 cycles down. We're also proposing converting a former transitional housing site that lost its federal funding into a 30-unit family shelter to increase our capacity there by 30 beds.
Where's that at?
Ninth and Howard.
Harbor House. I'm not quite sure the exact location. 407 Ninth Street. Yeah. Okay. 407 Ninth Street. Thank you. 30 units, not beds. Apologies. I will change this. Not beds. All right. And also expanded youth outreach and drop-in services. Another major area of investment is in addressing street homelessness. So our budget includes funding to open a new 24/7 resource center to provide respite from the street and a place where our outreach workers can bring clients to have a rest, take a shower, and receive some service connection. There's also funding to increase stabilization beds so that our outreach workers are able to bring our most vulnerable clients into shelter. And pending the round two of the whole person care, which is a 5-year pilot Medi-Cal program that we're working in concert with DPH on. We received confirmation of round one funding back last summer. We've applied for round two, and we're still waiting to hear. But if so, we'll also be able to increase ERT as well as some different housing stabilization programs. Lastly, on exits from homelessness, our budget includes funding for the Moving On initiative, the housing placements, and the one-time funding for folks who are going to be utilizing the federal vouchers moving out of permanent supportive housing because they no longer need the supportive services but still need the operating subsidy. And the funding in our budget will help locate where they can utilize those vouchers and pay for things like the deposit or furniture so that they're able to successfully move in. And this then opens up capacity in our existing PSH for homeless clients who need the supportive services. We also see a rather large expansion of rapid rehousing for families. That's $1.5 million in each year, and additional rapid rehousing vouchers for transitional age youth. And the budget also includes funding for 172 new units of permanent supportive housing, which were in the city's locally operated locally operated subsidy program. And then I wanted to highlight a few other key investments that our budget includes. The $2.9 million you are very familiar with, the HUD grant for TAE, so that we can work on creating a plan and services for that subpopulation. It also includes the anticipated whole person care round two funding. And while there was no positions added or requested to be added in city departments this year in the mayor's budget, we are grateful to say that we received 7 critical positions for kind of our administrative backbone so that we can really fully stand up as an independent agency next year. And it also includes funding for the site of a new headquarters in the spring of next year. And so next steps, we will have our first presentation to the Budget and Finance Subcommittee of the Board on the 16th and come back the following week on the 22nd. After that, the subcommittee deliberates and then typically passes the proposed budget onto the full board for July, usually around the third week of July. We would see it passed and then signed by the mayor. Do you have any questions that I could answer about our proposed budget?
Well, basically, what do you need from us? What do you need from us? Do you need us to appear with you some of these hearings or what? What do you need from us?
We should reach out on that. If we need any testimony, I'll coordinate with Sam.
Okay. Yeah, just you get through with the round here.
Oh, no. Any other questions from the board?
Also, do you anticipate doing any more hiring once you open up the new facilities? You've got seven positions already, right? From outside, you've hired from outside seven people?
We still have significant vacancies within the department.
Significant is how many?
I want to say it's around like 20-something.
Wow, fantastic.
Yes, there's several on my team. So we've hired, I believe, we've made 50 hiring placements in this year, which is really significant for a department of our size.
Yeah.
And I think 30 of those were whole new placements, but I don't have a hiring plan in front of me. But we post our openings on our website, so I encourage anyone who's interested in openings to please take a look and to apply.
Are you interested in hiring any of the formerly homeless, or maybe possibly the homeless that are in our shelters, that make navigation centers now?
Absolutely, yeah.
And how are you doing that? How are you putting that out?
I mean, we have it on our website, and it's on the city's website as well.
Okay.
I couldn't speak to like any particular HR recruitment efforts, but I can look into that and get back to you.
I mean, because I would love to see people making decisions in your department that are homeless or formerly homeless. Some people that spend on the ground, some key people in your department that exactly sit down at the table, giving their sides, giving their opinions, giving their experience, you know, rather than have a department that's entirely made up of people that have not experienced that part of life. So if you will consider that even more great, I think we would be really, really behind you. Not that we are behind you already, but that would be that would make a great, great situation. Thank you.
Sure, last question. The funding for those 172 additional units of permanent supportive housing, it says that during the next two fiscal years, they'll be ready for use during the next two fiscal years?
Yes.
I'm afraid. If we have no more questions from the board.
Say a little bit more about that. So I just want to say a little bit about that, you might have read a little bit in the paper about 1064, 1068, Mission Street, which is federal surplus property, and there was a change in the law that went into effect last fall that made the federal government have to offer up that parking lot. And in order to apply for that, we have to have a pretty aggressive plan about really converting it into permanent supportive housing, building there on the site on a rapid timeline. So that's part of...
That is not included in the 172.
Okay.
The 172 is just the planned pipeline. So if additional opportunities like that come up, we'd have more inventory.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. Great, thanks, Sam.
Thank you.
Do we have any public comments?
San Francisco has a city first model. And I'm wondering how that applies to all of this that she's talking about. And I was looking at the Navigation Center's 1 year auditor's report, and I'm wondering, is there any budget monies, or is there any desire for them to have the city auditor audit these services as they're coming along? I think they had like a 3 month, a 6 month, and a year's auditor's report.
Great, thank you. Next public comment?
Can we get an answer? Can we get an answer?
It's public comment time. It's not a question and answer. Great.
Should I FOIA the answer? Should I FOIA the questions?
I'm sorry?
Should I FOIA the information?
FOIL?
FOIA.
Freedom of information.
Yes.
Hello again.
So really quickly, I think there was a line over there.
Oh, no,
okay. Great, thank you.
Hi. So one of the things I was talking about before was the need for on-site transition support while we are in the midst of our encampment and shelter and housing shortage crisis. And so just this last couple weeks, I've been working with a particular encampment to try to coordinate on-site support for transition, as well as to coordinate efforts around DPW cleaning and deep cleans and things of that nature. And what was interesting is there was a deep clean that was scheduled and hot workers came out and they put a notice out there, and it didn't have any information about how to contact people or what the clear directives were for the deep clean. So it caused a lot of confusion. And I was trying to think, well, what are the hot workers actually doing here? Because I was confused because I didn't see them coming out consistently. And one of the things that I was hoping for is that we could get a hot worker or two to come out once a week or once every 2 weeks at that site. So there would be, you could know that every other Friday, there's a hot worker here who can help you with transition support. Because right now there are a lot of people at that encampment who need help with IDs, food stamps, Medi-Cal, like these things that I want to help them, I want to help people assist them in their transition, but I'm only one person and I can't take on too much of a case management role. But to coordinate with the hot workers who would come out every other week or every week, instead of what's going on right now, which is hot workers try to find a person and sometimes they get moved around and they're not able to find them where they are in the encampments. The idea is that the hot workers would come, and I would love to see some of the budget going to this. I did see that Project Homeless Connect just recently put out a van, or they're going to be doing more of those on-site services. But as we think about how to allocate those funds for hot workers, maybe doing some more of that on-site transition support would be a focus.
Great, thank you.
Which encampment are you speaking of specifically, Mel?
Pardon?
Which encampment are you speaking? The one that you've been working with? What's the location?
There's two. There's actually at Taharo and Barry. The majority of Fox City residents who are living in those terrible conditions, they're now over a few blocks still living in those conditions. So that's one. But there's another one that's by the Crescent Cove Apartments. And I'm happy to take you out there and meet with the residents there because they've been asking for this.
Yeah, I meet with the hot team and the other department leaders every Wednesday, so I'll take your concern to them on Wednesday morning.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next person.
I'm coming to talk about family and homelessness. I'm a family mother that's experienced homelessness. I experienced homelessness almost like 4 years ago. I was put into a supportive housing system. I was forced to use my redevelopment certificate to move there. Then I found out that it wasn't permanent housing. So that's one thing I want to talk about. Another thing that, you know, what they're talking about building these subsidy housing, they're talking about 3 years from now. There are families out here that are homeless right now. So what are you going to do about that? You know, you have a process where the families only can stay in the shelter for 3 months. Where do they go there after that? You go back to your cars, you go back there. The family thing is so much higher than, you know, I'm not, you know, trying to say something about a single parent being homeless, because I took my kids went to stay with their dad, and I experienced homeless on the streets of San Francisco. I had to go to a program for 3 months, then come back and started working with the Homeless Coalition to get back on track, because I couldn't find the services, because every time I went to one of them, I couldn't access nothing. They were taking me in circles. So what I'm trying to tell you that family homelessness is very, it's a lot. There's a lot of people that's homeless in family. They're sleeping on their family's couches. You know, they're sleeping, you know, at friends' house, maybe they're paying them, then the friends say, we gotta leave, then they have to leave. And so where are these services? Where are these people that are supposed to be helping people, you know, get around the situation? You know, it's too much money in the city of county of San Francisco. They have services that you can access, but you need to stabilize a person somewhere.
Thank you. And I agree, there is a big problem with family homelessness. It's much more prevalent than people think, and it's not as visible as people are aware. But we're hoping with the new family coordinated entry system and the WEN system, a lot of these issues that you've been experiencing, hopefully, will be lessened in the future.
You people standing, can I ask you not to block the door, because we'll have the fire marshal up here. Fire Marshal Bill will be up here. So grab a seat or make yourself comfortable. Thank you. As long as we don't block the door.
Hello, my name is Julia D'Antonio. I work at the Coalition on Homelessness. I'm a formerly homeless mother and a formerly homeless youth of San Francisco. So I'm here just to say I would like to see, as part of this budget, money going to moving the First Friendship Family Emergency site to a site that has showers, a site that families potentially don't have to leave at 6 a.m. with all their things, that they have a place to put their things. And the other thing I wanted to talk about as well is the job postings for the new homeless department. If we could see those in resource centers, family resource centers, like HPP, Compass, also any single adult resource centers, even if you guys could just send one out to the community so we can post it up at the Coalition, and really just emphasize that those should be the prioritized applicants, right? Because this affects us, this affects our friends, our family, our community. So thank you, Justin Moore, for saying that.
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Next person.
Hi. I am from Jackson. Patrick, my best to speak. So my thing is having access to showers and laundry for families, because every day we have a shuttle that takes us to 13th and Mission, and we are around a lot of women that are sick and don't take care of themselves. So I don't really mean, but it's not where you want your kids to be, you know, just so you can have a little dignity to keep clean. It would be also nice if, you know, it was a separate place for families to do shower and laundry and have a drop-in center to stay out of the cold in the morning. Since for family friendship, you have to be up at 6 a.m. in the morning, not by 7. And kids sleep, or the kids are getting sick, and us, we're getting sick too. For the women's center, I've had problems with peeping toms. People will come into the showers and they will just stare. And I think I've filed a complaint about that, but nothing's been really resolved about that. They still come in. But, you know, the family showers, they've been closed down for about 2 weeks. So it was actually especially hard to find a place to do showering. So now we have to shower with all the other women. The cleanliness is not clean at all, because yesterday I was waiting 3 hours to shower and I took a picture. There was urine on the floor and they expected me to clean that up and watch my kids. So that was fun. So I also had to ask for the bleach personally, because they only gave me some pine salt to clean up the mess. So the treatment is basically, you know, you're being treated like a second class citizen, which is bad. First Friendship, they're not real open about shower tokens and bus tokens. Pretty much more staff don't know about it. So you have to go to the higher up to pretty much inquire about it. Last week there was a community meeting about it, and they were saying that they had expired shower tickets and were waiting for new ones.
We have about 5 seconds left.
Okay. There's also surveillance in the family shelter, even in the nursery, which is where I don't like to change my child, which is uncomfortable.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you very much.
Thank you for sharing your concerns.
Hi, Jennifer Friedenbach, Coalition on Homelessness. I want to just do kind of a quick summary of the HESLA budget, what got funded in the mayor's budget. I have some packets for you all as well. That is also packets for the agenda item we're presenting on around coordinated entry. So HESPA is a group of 27 homeless service providers in San Francisco. From Coalition on Homelessness's perspective, we're doing a lot of outreach to homeless folks, getting their input, bringing that to HESPA, and then a budget request is developed. This year we put in a $9.5 million budget in year one and $14 million in year two. That included 500 subsidies, two new shelters. As was pointed out with First Friendship with the families, we have an emergency shelter that has no beds, that you have to leave every morning and it has no showers. People have to go to the women's drop-in center for showers. That's untenable. In the Bayview, we have a situation where we have 40% of the homeless population is there. It's the second highest homeless population, only about 7% of the services, a very underserved community. Those two things were really top on our list. They did not appear in the budget with the mayor. Harbor House is basically going to keep us at the same level. It's not going to add capacity. We need to add capacity, and we need to address what we're doing to African Americans in the Bayview that are homeless. For the 500 subsidies, some of the subsidies, as was reported, were funded in the mayor's office, specifically around youth and some rapid rehousing around families. But a number of the other subsidies that we were trying to get were not funded either. We also have requests around trying to address the funding disparities. The services in the Bayview, again, we have a drop-in center that is in just dire need of case management. We have a shelter that funding is much lower, about half as much they get per client per night than any other shelter. We want to try to get that up, and that way they would be employees that could actually get health benefits and some things that is they're really not being funded in a way that they get kind of equal share on homeless services. Thank you.
Thanks, Jennifer.
And just keep in mind, you know, there's three other processes this has to go through, Jennifer. And as you know, on the second floor, the Board of Supervisors, we still have a chance.
Yes, which is why we're bringing it up to you.
Good, okay.
There's to get your help. Yeah.
Yes, ma'am. Of course, you.
Do we have any other public comment for this issue? All right, let's move on to the next agenda item. We have a presentation from the Shelter Grievance Advisory Committee, Cindy Ward of HSH.
Good morning, committee members. I'm Cindy Ward. I'm the manager for Family, Youth, and Prevention Services at HSH. I've also been sort of the staff to the Shelter Grievance Advisory Committee and have oversight over the shelter grievance policy pretty much for my full time at HSA and then HSH. So I'm going to talk really briefly about what the shelter grievance policy is and then why we're before you today. So the shelter grievance policy, back in 1990, it's been that long, a group of community advocates came to what was then the Department of Social Services and the mayor's office talking about abuses that were going on in the shelter system. So at that time, any client could be asked to leave a shelter for any reason, and there really didn't have to be a reason given. They could just be asked to leave. And there was no way that the clients could appeal that decision that was made by the shelter. There was nowhere for them to go to complain. So for about a year and a half, there was a process between those community advocates, DSS, and the mayor's office, and they came up with the original shelter grievance policy. It was implemented in April of 1992, and it was 3 pages long. So at that same time, the Shelter Grievance Advisory Committee was formed. And I will just read you. The Shelter Grievance Advisor Committee is an independent 10 to 15 member oversight committee composed of representatives that include advocates, shelter providers, consumers, city agencies, an arbitrator, and community members. And it goes on to say what slots will be for what members. So that group has met quarterly going back to 1992. And the oversight for the policy and the Shelter Grievance Advisory Committee was provided by the Department of Social Services, then the Department of Human Services Commission. Fast forwarding for 25 years, the policy changes were made over time. The policy now that you see before you is 24 pages long. That mostly had to do with the fact that when you actually implement something, things come up that you didn't think about, and now you're thinking about them, and now they have to be covered by the policy. So those decisions were recommended by the Shelter Grievance Advisory Committee and ultimately approved by the HSA Commission. So all shelters that receive city funding must use this policy. It's not optional, it's required. And what the policy mainly does is lay out what happens when clients break shelter rules and when they receive warnings and or what we call DOSs or denials of service, which means they're being asked to leave the shelter. And it also lays out the protocols for the client's right to due process or appeal of those denials of service at what's called the internal hearing at the shelter, and ultimately the adaptive arbitration where the decision is final and is made by a neutral third-party arbitrator. Our neutral third-party arbitrators are all volunteer attorneys who get trained in the arbitration process and the shelter grievance policy, and they are the ones who make the final decisions on any denial of service. And again, this is our entire shelter system, families, singles. So HSH also funds a contract to provide client advocate services. Mr. Daly, who spoke earlier, is one of those client advocates. And as I alluded to, April 2017 marked the 25th anniversary of the shelter grievance policy. As far as we know, nothing else like it exists anywhere in the country. I occasionally get calls for asking, you know, about the policy and how it got set up and what it is. But as far as I know, there's nothing that's like it anywhere else. When the new department was formed, the HSA Commission transferred authority to this body, the Local Homeless Coordinating Board, in their August 2016 commission. And I will read from the minutes of that. Unanimously, the commission approved the revisions to the shelter grievance policy to reflect transfer of functions from the Human Service Agency to the new Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing. And the commission approved transfer of the Shelter Grievance Advisory Committee member appointments from the Human Services Commission to the Local Homeless Coordinating Board with current membership and roles intact. So the role that we are asking you to play at this point, it hasn't been necessary, which is why we've had a little bit of a lag time in coming to present to you, and your agendas are always really full. So when there needs to be new appointments to the Shelter Grievance Advisory Committee, we will be asking you to approve those appointments. Historically, the chair of the Shelter Grievance Advisory Committee has been a Human Services Commissioner who has volunteered to play that role. Currently, our current chair is HSA Commissioner Scott Kahn, who has agreed to continue to play the role even though the policy was sort of transferring oversight. In the March 2017 Shelter Grievance Advisory Committee meeting, a motion was made to allow, the motion was made to recommend to the Local Homeless Coordinating Board that the shelter grievance policy be amended to basically remove two words. If you look at policy currently, the selection process for new members says, as stated above, SGAC members and chair are appointed by the Local Homeless Coordinating Board. HSH will notify everyone on the mailing list and community to try to recruit new members when that happens. What the Shelter Grievance Advisory Committee voted on in March was to recommend two things. To recommend to this body that the shelter grievance policy be amended to remove the chair. So basically it would say SGAC members are appointed by the Local Homeless Coordinator Board. What the SGAC would like to do is actually choose their own chair. And this motion was approved unanimously. And what we're asking you to do today is take action on that, meaning that when there is a vacancy in the chair position, which there isn't currently, but when there is, that the membership of the Shelter Grievance Advisory Committee will be allowed to choose their own chair, which would then be approved, hopefully, by you and appointed by you. So that's the action that we're asking you to take. I do want to recognize
Yes.
I do want to recognize Jeff Livingston, who's here today. He's actually one of our original arbitrators, which goes back a really long time. I want to ask Will Daly to read a piece on Arnett Watson, who was the original client advocate. Before that, I will just say briefly, since it has come up, about the navigation centers and the shelter grievance advisory, no, sorry, the shelter grievance policy. The HSH program managers are going to be meeting about the potential impacts of expanding the policy to the navigation centers. I think as Sam relayed, HSH is not against this. I think it does have larger implications for our system of arbitrations, which is very longstanding. And we just have to review the implications. So that will be coming shortly.
Cindy, I'm sorry.
Yes.
When will that meeting be held?
It has not been scheduled because it's really hard to get everybody. I would say in the next 2 weeks it'll be held.
So it's likely you can give an update at the next meeting?
Yes.
Thank you. Great. Thank you, Cindy.
Arnett Watson was instrumental in bringing the grievance policy to the city. And this is from an article about her in the Street Sheet. Arnett Watson made us who we are. In 1988, while she was a tenant at one of the city's first transitional housing programs for homeless folks, Arnett began a career as an ardent spokesperson for social justice that would continue interrupted until her death. While working as an organizer at the Coalition on Homelessness, Arnett helped create an innovative fair hearing process for homeless shelter residents and became a national model. For more than a decade, Arnett was lead staff for the city-funded community-driven initiative to ensure due process protections for homeless individuals and families living in shelters. Working with public interest attorneys, advocates, and social workers, Arnett helped develop the creative mediation slash conflict resolution training for shelter staff, advocates, and city workers. Arnett touched the lives of hundreds of homeless people in her work, and earned the respect of colleagues and adversaries alike because of her commitment to fairness for all people and her unshakable integrity. She leaves an impressive body of work as advocate, mentor, advisor, and teacher, having influenced dozens of emerging leaders in the struggle for social justice and economic justice. And so as a shelter client advocate, I always ask myself, what would Arnett do? I have further comments about other things. I can wait till public comment, whatever you feel is best.
I think public comment would be best.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
I just want to add one more thing. We do monthly shelter grievance policy trainings for staff. So all new shelter staff is required to attend a grievance training. It's usually 2.5 hours where one of my staff, Jamari Colas, goes over the policy and talks about how it works in shelters and basically trains staff. So if any members are ever interested in attending that training, you'd be welcome.
Great. Thank you, Cindy.
So what exactly are you asking us to do today exactly?
So the current policy says that formerly HSA, now this body, makes appointments to the Shelter Grievance Advisory Committee and approves appointments. How that's looked previously with the HSA Commission is that someone applies to the committee and says, I'm interested. We bring that person before this body and ask you to approve their appointment. That's how it's worked in the past. And how it's worked in the past is that an HSA commissioner has volunteered to be chair. That was just sort of one of their duties. One of them who was interested would volunteer to be chair for the body. And there is a current chair who is a current HSA commissioner. But if that person chooses to leave and that chair position is vacant, the Shelter Grievance Advisory Committee membership is asking that they be allowed to choose their own chair as opposed to have them appointed by this body. Although, given the language and the policy, this body would still have to approve that chair that the Shelter Grievance Advisory Committee voted on.
Well, you know, I guess this is something we need to talk about, but I would suggest that we have Charles, our analyst, look into the liabilities of that or the legalities of that, see exactly what we can do and what we can't maybe, and then Charles can present us our position where we're at, and then we can re-agenda for the next meeting, and then we can take it for later action and a vote. How's that sound? Do we need to discuss this anymore now?
I agree.
And as far as the, you know, the grievance policy affecting the navigation centers, just my personal thing, navigation centers are navigation centers. They're not shelters. I don't miss, but first of all, the navigation center definitely needs some type of oversight, such as the grievance policy. I don't know what's in place now, but I don't see how the shelter grievance policy would fit the navigation center. That's a very unique operation, very unique project. And with the curfew being different, the people bringing in pets and belongings, thank God, is definitely not the same as a shelter. So maybe we need to customize something that will fit that well because it's a completely different operation. So that's just my personal, not the board, just my personal feeling.
So my personal opinion is that there should be some type of grievance policy that applies to the navigation center. You know, having a two-tiered system, it complicates things. Mm-hmm. It makes it confusing for residents in both situations.
So just so you know, and I knew this is a very short agenda item, so I didn't go as far into the policy as I certainly could have, but the policy doesn't dictate what the programs, and I'll just say program, not shelter, but the policy doesn't dictate what the program's rules are. What the policy dictates is that the program has rules, that they're written down, that they're posted so people can understand them, and that they're explained to the client. So the difference would be, and the difference would be, how do you enforce whatever the navigation center rules are, which I agree with you are very different than the shelter rules. So I think we could work on, you know, how could this policy work for the navigation centers, keeping in mind that they are very different types of operations.
Thank you, Cindy. So we're going to open it up. Do we have any questions from the board, everyone? All right, we'll open it up to public comment.
So if you read the contracts of the navigation center, and if you read the contracts of the drop-in services, it says they're supposed to be under agreements, policy, and procedure. So, you know, but the way the city attorney is interpreting it, all of that stuff goes out the window. We got a grievance policy because, remember, the staff were having sex with the clients and selling beds for sex. My situation is this grievance policy has some direct bigotry against homelessness in it, so we shouldn't just make two changes. We should stop and review the whole thing. Let me see. The policy just had excessive problems. They gave me less than 24 hours for my notice for a hearing, and then the shelter staff was violent towards me, and when you look at page 7 of your document, it only talks about the clients being biased. So, and it's like, she didn't even respond to me when I was trying to get this investigated, get the grievance process going. She just didn't care. And it's still in the middle of investigation because they don't take drop-in centers serious. They just want to skirt their contract. It's in your contract, Sam. And they're supposed to be following it. It's just like they refuse to follow the contract. Then we need to have some conversation about video and when it should be used and when we should see it. And there's discrepancies where the shelter has free reign to miss appointments, and then if the homeless person misses an appointment, then the process ends. So there's some serious bigotry. It's like 4 or 5.
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you. Next person.
So I want to submit to you that currently the clients of the navigation center are in the same position as the shelter residents in 1990 or the grievance policy of the institute. And I heard what you said about you feel it's a different model, and absolutely it's a different model. They have different roles, but it's considered a shelter by the administrative code. Even by the mayor's own budget, it defines a navigation center as, let's see here, quote, low threshold service intensive shelters. It's a shelter, okay? So the grievance policy, I feel strongly, should cover all shelters, regardless of whether they're a navigation center, some other type of shelter. HESPA's for this, Episcopal Community Services now operates 2 the navigation centers, and eventually they'll have the majority of navigation center clients. They want it. HESPA wants it. It was in the budget. And speaking to Mr. Dodge's comment, as of Friday, Director Kaczynski says he was not. So I don't know what changed, but he said he was not willing to have the grievance policy in the navigation center. And I want to reiterate that back in March, unanimous vote of the Shelter Grievance Advisory Committee recommended that the grievance policy be brought to the navigation centers. So I feel that part of your role is to, it says on your website, the local homeless board works to ensure a unified homeless program. The other issue I want to bring to you very briefly is that if you are a single adult and you have a 90-day reservation with the option to for another 30-day extension, and you go to the hospital, you have one day off of curfew, so you can lose your bed while you're in the hospital. And the city policy is that you can only be excused for one day. The SGAC sent a letter to HSA, HSH a year ago asking that the policy be amended.
Thank you, sir. Great.
We're still waiting. I have two handouts for you. Thank you.
Thanks.
Sam, I think it'd benefit the board if we, if there was an official response from HSA around the grievance policy, adoption of the grievance policy for navigation centers. You know, I don't know, maybe it's going back to Jeff and having a conversation about it and reporting back at the next meeting.
Sure.
You know, it sounds like, you know, what you said earlier and what Cindy has intimated as well, that there are some, there's a process that's happening to make that happen, it seems like. But if there is, you know, some, I don't know, a formal, I guess, inclination for HSA to avoid going that route, I think we should know that.
Okay.
Great. Yeah. Thanks, Sam. Do we have any other public comment?
Hi, I'm Karen Bernison from Episcopal Community Services, and I wanted to underscore what Will had said, that ECS operates the Nextdoor shelter, the Sanctuary shelter, and two of the navigation centers, and we are very much in support of the shelter grievance policy applying to the navigation centers as well. And Cindy's right that the city needs to resource that so that the additional right is meaningful. There was a request in the HESPA budget for $14,000 for an additional advocate to support folks going through that process. And we certainly hope that that ends up in the budget.
Great, thank you.
Karen.
So I wanted to just speak in support of both changing the hospital stay policy, which is a really long time coming and should have been implemented already, having folks already have the stress of a medical emergency and then losing their bed during that isn't, I think, a policy any of us would want to support. When that person's hospital stay is done, they're then on the streets, right? And it's at least a five-week wait to get into shelter. So the second piece is around the grievance procedure. So there's a lot of, I think, you know, confusion around how it works. All the grievance procedure is doing is holding the program to whatever rules they have. So we already have a lot of diversity in the shelter system in terms of, we used to have a lot more and we lost that. But, you know, there's different philosophies of the organizations that run them. There's different rules, which as there should be, because some of the shelters are set up to serve particular populations, and there are different sizes and all of that stuff. The navigation center, it would work the same way. So you would be holding them to whatever rules they have. The rules would be different, yes. Mm-hmm. That's not a problem. They're already different. But we are hearing from people in the navigation centers that feel that they have been put out wrongly. And one of the beautiful things about the grievance procedure is that it's really helpful for the staff as well as the clients, because it creates this structure for people to get together and try to address the issues that are coming up, instead of just putting people out. And the providers all opposed it to start with. And then they supported it once it came in place, because it really was helpful. It's also helpful for staff not to have that on their shoulders. If there is an arbitration, it's decided by an independent body, and they can feel good that there's going to be due process as they're moving forward. And so we really strongly recommend that get implemented. It's a small amount of money, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Jenny.
Yeah, based on what you said, let me reread this policy again, Jennifer, and maybe I can convince myself to agree with that. Because what you said made a lot of sense. Thank you.
Doesn't look like there's one more public comment?
No.
Great, thanks.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Bell. I just wanted to say that I have heard since my
last attendance at a different meeting about the navigation centers, and I do believe that they should be have some sort of grievance policy, because as in any situation, you do need some sort of oversight. And when somebody brought up the hospital issue, it also brought up something for me, because I'm kind of misplaced at the moment. Being a single parent and being in a shelter for single people, I often have to go, especially since it's summer, to visit my children. So I stay every other weekend with one son. I stay every couple of weeks with my other son. I may have to go on vacation. So in doing all this, even though I alert the shelter because of policies and because of how GA works in the beds and the 90-day shelter, I may lose my bed because of the other obligations that I have in my life and being misplaced at this time and not being able to get the services that I need for my family. And so it kind of leaves me in that situation too, where I may have to say, you know, I realize you've got these policies for certain reasons, for people who may go out and never come back, but I had to go out to take care of my family and come back. And that's an obligation that I had before I got here. Thank you.
Thanks for sharing. We'll move on to the next agenda item. We have a presentation from the Homeless Emergency Services Program Association, HESPA.
And I know we have a lot of presenters, so let's keep in mind our time, because we want to get everyone who's slated for the agenda on in front of us today. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you. We will try to go through this as rapidly as possible. Thank you for having us back, and good afternoon. So the member agencies of HESPA have already stated to you all that last month that we're very encouraged that the city is embarking on this process to really go through a large systems change to implement a family-coordinated entry system with the shared goals that we help families resolve their housing crisis within 90 days here in San Francisco, that we use a shared information system, the One System that Sam already referred to, that families facing a housing crisis can access services through a coordinated entry access point, call a hotline, be referred via outreach teams and mainstream services such as schools, community and safety net services, and then have an intake interview and triage that will use a coordinated tool across the system. And after initial intake, the goal is that families can refer directly and immediately to available shelter and housing services to address their needs. We completely agree with that ideal, and we've been excited to embark on implementing this system with the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing since about this past December, when we started to implement a new eligibility and prioritization process for shelter. This prioritization system defines a San Francisco homeless family as having stayed in San Francisco during the past 7 days, or having a child enrolled in San Francisco Unified School District or child care in San Francisco. And it prioritizes shelter for unsheltered families. That's the basis. But as we're going through the implementation of this, we are seeing where some families are being left out. So our remarks today are recommendations in regard to that, as well as looking at the larger system of the department. I'm still messing it up. But they recently had an RFP for access point services, and we're concerned that the funding for these services must augment our current services with an adequate problem-solving case management that will help families divert from needing shelter and identify housing solutions so that there's a housing exit piece to the shelter exit. So the exit that combines with the entrance through the shelter access piece. We're concerned if there is not adequate funding, the coordinated entry system could become a revolving door system where families are turned away because there are limited resources and their prioritization for some families and not others. My colleagues today are going to speak to more specific points in regards to the implementation of the system.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Board, for your time. With regard to recommendations for a more inclusive and participatory process, we're encouraged that HSH has begun the CES implementation and created a learning work group to work together to focus on problem solving for the system. Our recommendation is that these work groups include a clear process for decision making and are open, inclusive, and participatory, including representation from family members who have experienced homelessness or are experiencing homelessness, and from the domestic violence provider community. This work group should have two subcommittees, a homeless parents subcommittee to focus on input from the community and a domestic violence subcommittee. We asked multiple times for a separate process for domestic violence providers to work out the many policies regarding this particular population and allowing for DV survivors to access non-secure shelter. We're thankful that you have been responsive to our colleagues at Safe Start and the DV consortium members and the implementation and working group, but we are we still hope that they are even further included into the system and implementation process, and we hope that you further expand this to a more focused effort to communicate and train DV providers on the new process and their role by creating that separate DV provider work.
Good afternoon. Given the recent HSH award announcements for access points and emergency hotel rooms for pregnant women, we're very concerned about the limited resources being allocated to adequately support this whole system change. The change, again, is welcomed, but without the adequate resources, it will be really challenging to implement. There's currently a heavy backlog also of need from families. So year over year, we've seen about a 19% increase in families staying on the street or car or other places that are not meant for human habitation. And a quarter of these families are staying on the floor in emergency shelters without regular shower access or ability to stay during the day. And under HSH's new prioritization system as well, these families that are staying in emergency shelters have very little chance of accessing stable shelters. So that's sort of the maybe unintended consequence of having this new prioritization, and so we look for that to be addressed. In addition, we recommend that all pregnant women should be top priority for including pregnant moms who are sheltered or in unstable housing, and that the city should really explore specific housing options for moms in these situations, given that there is an increased stress level and higher risk of preterm birth for moms that are experiencing homelessness, which have long-term negative impacts on the health of the child as well as mom. So, thank you.
Thank you.
So, Jennifer Friedenbach, just building on that, we have a situation where our families are stuck. We don't have enough shelter. We don't have enough housing, which we were trying to address with the HESPA request. So on the family piece, just to break it down, we requested 130 subsidies for families, hotel vouchers, and a new family emergency shelter. There was included rapid rehousing in the mayor's budget. So of the $1.7 million requested for homeless families in year one, and $5 million in year two, the department funded $3 million split across those 2 years. We are really heartened that HSH has worked with us to address some of the concerns raised previously regarding the prioritization of families. We've seen an increase in direct referrals from HOT. You know, we really want to get those families off that are on the street that have kids directly into stable shelter. But we have a number of San Francisco homeless families who stay with friends temporarily outside of SF because our black and brown population has been so displaced, but they're San Francisco families. They got their kids in informal child care, or they're in benefits, or in San Francisco, or they are working in San Francisco, and that makes them disqualified for help in outside counties. So one of the things we're asking is that our policy align with those outside counties, which Gary agreed to look at. And we also have really a lot of concerns about shelter access for families staying in those one-night shelters. So if we're having those families stay at First Friendship for long times, like a year, and it's just indefinite, they're going to be there, that's not okay. We're permanently damaging the children that are staying there. As you heard from the moms today, how difficult it is for them. Their children are really suffering. And we see the children deteriorate as the longer and longer they are. We also have families that have life-threatening medical conditions that, because of our new prioritization process, are not able to access stable shelter and therefore are denied life-saving medical treatment. So we're asking for some nuance. Not everyone fits in the boxes, and we want some nuance in this so that when we identify those families, we need to get them into stable shelter, and that's been a real challenge. You know, we want that communication that's consistent with the families, clear understanding, so the families have a clear understanding of how the system works and how they can access the new ones. There's lots of exciting changes in our system, but we should not make the same mistakes moving forward. We're moving forward on coordinated entry for housing. We made a lot of mistakes on the shelter piece. A lack of inclusion in process, a lot of, you know, just policy mistakes because we didn't have the input from the homeless families that we should have. We are also embarking on that for single adults, same lessons apply. The department's starting to be much more inclusive with the learning work group, which we're really excited about. They did that youth advisory, which is awesome, and soon there's gonna be the parent council. So that's really awesome. So things are shifting around, but there's still some unaddressed issues that we'd like to see some action on. Thank you.
Thanks, Jenny.
And you guys have questions? These guys can come forward.
Do you have any questions from the board?
Well, just that, you know, what you're doing and what you're advocating for is great. And there are several members of the department here in attendance today. I hope they are listening to you. I hope they listen to the testimony that you all made. You didn't specifically ask us to do anything today, just to listen. Which is what we're doing. And keep in mind what I said before, there's three more opportunities for the budget committee downstairs to know where this money is going for that the mayor has asked. And there's still a chance to change. Bring your passion, bring your mothers, bring your kids to that, to one or maybe all three of those hearings. And let them know, because I've seen things change in that room downstairs where it was locked in gold and people went in with a passionate voice and view and things changed. This is the government building, you know. And again, as I said the other day to people, this is the government, not right here, not downstairs. This room is the government right here. We run this. We make the decisions, not those people downstairs. They're the second person and we're the first person. So as long as we let them know that we are really the government, things will go well for us. That's just a little something.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
If we don't have any other questions from the board, then we can move to public comment.
Hi, my name is Jennifer. I've been encouraged to come here and speak to you again. I already spoke to a board once, the shelter monitoring board. I was taken off the list in February due to some policies that changed here. That's what I was told by my representative at Compass. I was told in February that we were on the priority list for a year, my family, to get into Compass. The only way to access family housing in San Francisco and to get any financing is through the family shelters. And my older son has wanted them. Okay, he's 15. He's in a wonderful school right now. But I can't take him into a nightly shelter. That's not in his best interest, and I have an agreement with his father. We have shared custody, and it would not do my son any good socially. It would not impact him well, even as a 15-year-old, to take him into an unknown. That's not safe, that I don't know what it's like, and that's out of his routine. So that would not help our family. I also have a younger son who's 11, who's living in the valley, and who's neglected. You know, he's already drinking. He doesn't spend any time with his dad after school until his dad gets home at 8. And I don't have any say in that. Because of Care Not Cash, I get a whole $66 a month now because I'm living in a GA bed. My rent on my storage is $148. Therefore, I borrow about $90 at the beginning of every month. Therefore, I don't even have the money to go travel and Amtrak to see my other son anymore.
So summer's coming up. I'm trying to spend time with my children, and I wish that there was a way that we could find how we could get into the family shelters, because that's the closest to our family. Thank you.
Thank you. Next.
Hello. I just wanted to stress that I would love to see more family participation and meetings where coordinated entry is discussed, and just really make sure that decisions are made in those meetings and before we sit down, less of a presentation of what's going to happen and more questions of how would you like to see this happen to the people that are affected by these changes. And then I also just wanted to quickly read a statement made by a family who was not able to make it here today about coordinated entry, so let me just pull it up. The system should be accessible prior to putting families on the street for priority. What they're doing is exposing children to unnecessary trauma, placing them in harm's way of not only losing their home, but now mom and dad are. As CPS may be called for sleeping outside. So this is a family who has experienced this, that CPS was called, and she lost her child for 3 weeks after sleeping outside. So it's just something that we should consider as we're making these decisions, if priority should really go to families on the street, we should be incentivizing that, because that's the way families are taking it right now. So thank you.
Thank you. Next.
My name is Destiny. I think it's true. Families, families are afraid to seek help because some shelters like in Hamilton, I hear they're very quick to call CPS. If they, I don't know, for whatever reason, you know. So I think for a moment I was scared too. For like the shelters in Los Angeles, just before I came back up here, CPS and the whole system and all that—it's terrifying. You can't imagine, you know, having your child taken away, even if trying, you know. Anyways, what I wanted to talk about was storages for our families, like a separate storage. See, like that stroller back there. I got my computer, my hygiene, and extra stuff, and my stroller that I have to take with me every day. So whether my child's in school or not, I'm stuck with that stuff. And so I applied for Child Works last week, and you know, you got requirements to do, and you can't take that stuff to work while your kid's in child care. So that's pretty much my thing. Storage is families too. So we can storage for more needed things, for special needs, because 350 Jones, it's only clothes and shoes. No hygiene or anything. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Yes, I'd like to talk about the shelter system, how the access to get in. You know, like I told you before, I stayed in supportive housing. I'm dually diagnosed, so that's why I went to supportive housing. And I was asked to leave after CPS came in. I didn't want to be bothered with CPS. And so my kids went to stay with their dad. So they're with their dad. So under their thing, they're saying for people that's being reunification with their children within 90 days. Well, I don't go through CPS anymore. I'm in family court. So I went to family court Friday, which I could have got joint custody of my kids. Like I said, I've been working with the HOT team over 2 years. I went to get myself help when they had a certain director. The director told me, go on and do that. So when I went and did it, my name wasn't there. So Ms. Whipper, before she left, she helped me, and I got a case manager, that's Tommy. So I had to have surgery on my shoulder, too. So I had that. But during that time, they didn't give me a room. I got a room like 2 months after I had my surgery. And so after I had my surgery, I'm at the Riviera, and my case manager knows about my situation with my kids. I'm telling them that, you know, I'm going to court, I may be getting my kids, or, you know, so and so. So, but it's hard for a person that's going through family court if you don't want to go through the CPS system, and you want to go take it, you know, the way you want to. So I was just fortunate to have the kid's dad who took care of them, and now I'm ready to get my kids back. And so now I'm only offered for them to be with me for the summer, but I have nowhere for them to go at. For me, working with the hot team over 2 years, knowing that I was going to have family reunification sooner or later, but they're saying that they can't help me. So my thing is, my kids have to go stay with my godmother while I still continue to access the room and then find out what's going to happen on the 12th. You know, so I'm being held in Lumbar Bar because of, you know, they're only dealing with certain cases around CPS and not going for quarantine with family court. Family court is completely different from CPS.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, ma'am.
That blew my investment. I'm up here because I stayed in SRO with one of my sons, and I got two of them back, and they evicted me to my family's office. So now my kids are in juvenile because they've been running around in education. They evicted us. And me and my son, we out here standing in cars with couches, and I'm almost 50 years old. I got disabilities, and I'm struggling. I'm homeless all over again. I ripped all around San Francisco, everything they told me to do in that hotel, I did, but I didn't get no response back. I didn't get nothing back. I ran everywhere, did everything they told me to do. All I did was get evicted. And I felt that wasn't fair, because everything they told me to do, I did it. And this struggle with me and my son, and he's just now, he's standing with his dad, but really his dad is, put a big one on his head, he had to go to the hospital, so now he can't go to his father anymore. So like, we really struggling now. Because he was with his dad, and I was trying to find a sword to stay at, so it's so hard on me, you know. And I've been in the hospital, I'm stressed out right now. I'm only going to do, thank God I got a car, I got a license, so we can have somewhere to move around to. Or I wouldn't know where I'd be right now. I can't stay on the streets, I'd be dead if I sleep on the streets, you know. My son asked me every day, where we going the next day? He go to school, he public school, these boys' clubs, everywhere. When he got there, we don't have nowhere to go. I'm just crying, we both crying, like, we don't know what to do. So I need y'all help, I need some support, I need someone to stay at. I can't keep doing this to my baby, he only 8 years old, he deserved better. I got my kids back, 13 and 14, they was doing good, going to school, but they want to put them out due to my family size. What they told me to do is they gonna give me a bigger spot, and they never did, I was never years fighting for this housing. You know, it was one bedroom, but they said you can have four people in one bedroom. But they never happened. You know, all they did was put us out on the streets and take care of us. So we struggling. I need some support. My name is Leslie Buck. Please help.
Thank you, ma'am. Maybe after meeting one of the members of the new department can give you a referral or some navigation. Hopefully. Thank you, ma'am.
Okay. All right, we'll move on to the next item on the agenda. The HSH will give us a presentation on the encampment update.
Good afternoon, chairs and committee. I am Scott Walton. I am the manager over outreach and emergency adult services for the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing, and I'm here to give you a general overview of the encampment resolution team process. I should say that encampment resolution is something we started in August of 2016, but it really is just an expansion of ongoing outreach that we do. We have the homeless outreach team, which basically tries to address the issues that they find for people who are on the street and not in places fit for human habitation. But we realize that there are large encampments that have developed over time, tents, number of growing tents, improvised structures, parks, and so forth, and it's hard to resolve those when on a one-to-one approach, so we decided to try a model of encampment resolution. Our basic process is to identify a site. We pick our sites based on a combination of factors, size, number of people, number of structures, tents, length of time it's been there, and other issues that we get input from regarding calls, health concerns, and so forth. when we identify a site, we spend somewhere between 2 and 6 weeks working with that site. We have a very small team of currently 3 assigned people, and we've garnered a 4th to work at these sites. And basically what they try to do is do a survey and then an assessment of who's in the site. And our goal is to offer everybody in the site prior to what we label as a resolution day at least a temporary placement in a place of safety. Primarily those are at navigation center sites, but that's not exclusively all placements. The idea of having a resolution day is that we want to give people advance notice, and we also coordinate these efforts as well as across all our outreach now. We coordinate with the Department of Public Works, the Department of Public Health, and the San Francisco Police Department, although for encampments, we also involve a great number of additional departments. Some encampment sites involve MTA or Caltrans or the Sheriff's Office, depending on who has jurisdiction. We've used any number of city offices, planning, and so forth to help us determine what needs to happen at each specific site. As we approach a resolution day, we've made offers. We have taken people to these safety placements in advance, but it gets to the point where in 72 hours or more prior to a resolution date, we post, Public Works posts no parking signage so that we can have access to the site, and we post notices to those in the specific encampment saying that there will be a resolution date as of such and such a date. We continue to make offers to them. We are somewhat flexible on our resolution dates, that if there are a number of people who cannot resolve that day, we may come back the next day to resolve. Our goal is, once we've cleared an area, is to work to keep it clear, so companion work is done by a re-encampment prevention and response team that visit the sites once they've cleared, or once they've been cleared, to try to maintain those sites as cleared. To try to maintain their safety as well, and to work with the people who show up there, who may see it as a place to encamp, and ask them not to encamp there, and try to provide the same outreach we do to anybody on the street through the homeless outreach team. We are careful not to produce statistics about each encampment, because at times these include the occasional 5150 of someone or a referral to treatment, and in order to protect privacy, we basically aggregate our totals. But since August of 2016, we have cleared 11 sites, and 71% of the people at those sites that we had worked with took our safety placements. The other 30% chose not to and moved elsewhere or moved on over the course of our working in the site. Some people leave as soon as we show up. More people stay and make their choices as we go through the process with them. We, as of yet, don't have absolute detailed statistics about what happens following this. As I said, this process is less than a year old. We are very much looking forward to the One System as a way to really capture individuals' progress through all these different efforts, because clearly some of the people we've seen in encampments were involved at other encampments or were involved with the homeless outreach team before we targeted a specific location. And we are trying to use the One System. One of our big hopes for that is to build a real history for people so we can better focus our services with that. Currently, we are working on several sites in the Showplace Square area. And what I can also say about our efforts, of the 11 sites that have been cleared, only 3 of them have had a consistent, reoccurring re-encampment effort, and we continue to work with those sites. So we've had some success in the idea of these placements taking hold and these places remaining clear. We also, I need to say about this process, we use our office's public information officers and staff to work with neighbors, and partly that's because we want to reduce friction, we want to get their assistance in working with. We've had a number of successful community meetings, some that have involved both residents of the encampment and the neighbors, to try to build better understanding and also to try to build resources and set of things that will help. Occasionally, our re-encampment targets are based on city needs. So if there's a construction site coming up or a major project that requires an area to be cleared, that may be also a consideration for our clearing. So I just wanted to give a general overview, but leave time for you to ask questions and to really, hopefully you'll see this as part of the agency's overall outreach. And it's not a separate project, but working very much in conjunction with all our efforts to outreach to homeless people and try to provide them the services and options that we can provide.
Thank you, Scott. Do we have any questions from the board?
I do. I'm just wondering if you could provide some statistics or information about which encampments have been cleared. It seems like when I look around, it's the progress is not obvious, and I'd love to be able to share that with people.
Sure. I can provide you a list. I'd rather not try to remember them in my head.
Right.
But I can provide that information to the sites that we've worked on, and I'm happy to do that to the board.
And what percentage would you say of the encampment removals have been based on city needs?
I can only think of two right now, and one is pending, so it's only been one of the 11 so far. And it wasn't city needs, it was about, you know, projects with the area. So, for example, Islas Creek was one that was one of the first sites cleared, and it was related to the fact that that was a part port property and a part city property, and I wouldn't say it was so much city needs as community needs, because that was a park area that was really, at the time, unusable by people in the neighborhood because of all that was involved with encampment. So. I use the term city needs very broadly here. Mm-hmm. We consider all the people in encampments and the neighbors are all citizens of San Francisco. We are trying to respect that. We are also in our process of interacting with people in the encampments, trying to get them to understand that issues like blocking sidewalks, trash, human waste and so forth, dogs off leash, are issues that create fear and risk to neighbors, including other encamp neighbors, and so there are, you know, it's a combination of education. We don't have the resources to instantly clear all the encampments that you're aware of, so therefore we are trying to do this in a carefully responsible way with the clients of these targeted encampments, and yet try to provide education, because those that do not choose to take us up on the offer of placement are still on the street.
Thanks. And one other question, and you don't have any data on the 30% that aren't matriculating into shelters. You said that there are like 30% of the population that were transferred.
Well, we did not transfer them. My statistic is that of the people at encampments that we've targeted, which is over 400 people of the 11 encampments we've targeted, 29% actually chose not to take the options we had for placement.
Right.
So we don't have statistics on exactly where they are. We have anecdotal awareness that we'll run into them at another encampment, both either the homeless outreach team and their general outreach, or another encampment resolution team effort. But we at this point don't have statistics on that, and we are very eager to have that. But we need a system where all the interactions with a particular person are kept together so that we can look at the histories that are being created and how we may better serve them.
So at the beginning of this, well, close to the beginning of this project, the Local Homeless Coordinating Board was invited to join in for discussions and recommendations. So we, in fact, myself, I meet with Scott and his team in the mayor's office every Wednesday. And, you know, in this room today, I've heard a lot of stories that hurt my heart. It's refreshing to go to that meeting on Wednesday and really hear success stories. There are a lot of things in this building that just don't work. That office works, so I'm proud to be part of that. And if anyone on the board needs updates on what we're doing downstairs, just let me know, or the public. And Scott, thank you.
Well, and I'd like to add, I didn't speak about that. I talked about the encampment resolution team and how we partner with Public Works, Department of Public Health, and the San Francisco Police Department. But the Wednesday meeting that Co-Chair Seymour is referring to is actually a effort across many city departments to come together and make sure that what is needed is done on a specific encampment. So again, it can be jurisdictional issues. It can be looking at solutions that may be outside the norm. It also is a place where everybody who's out on the street and working in various components bring forward areas of their concern and changes that happen, which helps influence the sites we target. So that's a broader picture. We call that the encampment working group. It's a closed group of city departments that meet to better coordinate our efforts. But the encampment resolution team is actually a team within the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing that is just one part of that.
Great. Thank you, sir. I think we'll open it up for public comment now. Do we have any public comment?
Hello. I had a question to begin with. Do we know how many people have actually been like housed that we've touched base with on the street in encampments?
Scott, do you want to answer that? Or not? Okay.
As I shared, this program began in August, and therefore we do not have statistics yet on the ultimate outcomes for people. It's something we really do want, but you don't get that the first months a program is operating, especially when some of these projects take long term. Anecdotally, some people move on, and the next time they show up, we find them in an encampment, they may take us up on the offers. Anecdotally, somebody who takes a safe placement from one encampment and then chooses to leave that safe placement, we may see again and we may try to place again. One of the things I love about our department is we try to meet people where they're at, and it's not like you have your chance, don't go, but we don't have those statistics at this time.
Thanks, Scott.
Yeah, because I just see us using a lot of like positive words, I mean, as we should, I guess, but it creates this illusion that something's actually being done for people. And unless we're placing people into housing, we're just putting them back on the street. It's just a temporary band-aid, right, to like a problem. So I think we need to approach it from like a more realistic perspective as somebody who's been on the street. Because hearing this, it can be a little bit insulting. At least I take it that way. Yeah, if we could just bring those numbers too and really talk about real solutions instead of just we're putting them in a NAV center for 30 days and then of course they're going to be at a different encampment. I mean, that's pretty obvious.
Thank you. Next.
Yes, I'm going to talk about encampments. You know, I go to the hospital every week to prepare things. And certain area that was on the news, you know, and then they start going out here, you know, doing the camps and stuff. So, you know, the place that I usually go to when I go to the hospital, there usually be a lot of tents and stuff there. So now there are a lot of barricades, of police barricades around such areas that they don't want the homeless to be at. But I do find out that, you know, you go up a couple of blocks and if there's not no house over there or anything, there's, you know, people encamped there. And from that encampment area that I used to see that was spread from, you know, a few people, maybe 12 or 13, now you have encampment over maybe 60 or 70 people going up around the block around, you know, so there's no homes there. So my thing, what I see with the city when it comes to such things, and I feel that they need people that been there or been homeless can communicate with these people or have, you know, actually been, you know, in that environment to talk to these people and give them good suggestions, because people that, you know, if you ain't lived that life,
you can't comprehend. If someone sees someone that's been there, they're more inclined to, you know, say, oh yeah, let me try this. But other than that, they're not. So I'm just, you know, wondering how all this outreach stuff is going and stuff when I'm still seeing the same, you know, same things and money's being wasted. You know, that's how I feel. So.
Thank you.
Thank you,
ma'am. Thanks.
It would be cool if there was an organization that helped the low income start a business, because that's what I really want to do. They require me to do the 22 hours of work and then get some of the cash aid. But I want to pursue more than being stuck in that paycheck to paycheck. That's all I can think of right now. Let's establish the second one.
Thank you. We'll move on to our final. Sorry.
Yes, I just wanted to say that I've been staying at the woman's place on Mission, and 13 on Mission, and I think they're doing a great job by dealing with a very tough population to deal with, which is drug users, people with mental issues. And seniors that require total care, handicaps. And the only issue that there is, there should be more security, because, the staff is overwhelmed managing, in the past 4 months, I was assaulted 4 times by different females. I would like to see more authority, because sometimes they are handling like a medical emergency where a woman has a chest pain and assault going on in the restroom, and also trying to meet the other client's needs. So I think based on what they have, they're doing a fantastic job. That's my opinion. Also, I would like to have more resources for single women, because I'm not married, I don't have kids, and it's been extremely hard to find resources because I'm not a priority to society, but I feel like I have needs, and it was a personal choice not to have kids, but I shouldn't be punished for it. That's it.
Thank you, Mayor. Do we have any other public comment?
Let me ask, is the representative from Home Base here? Okay, maybe we need to do this. Can it wait till next month? Is this a calendar deal?
Yeah, it's just an update.
Okay, you don't mind?
Yeah.
Okay, because we have a hard close.
It's very fast.
Sorry, what?
It's very fast.
The presentation? Okay, we can do it then. Sure.
My name is Nancy Cross, CROSS, and I was. I wanted to come to this event, but I didn't hear until too late because I had a dentist appointment at 11 o'clock, and I rushed over here to try to get at least a word in. I'm particularly concerned about any advancing in thinking on the Shelter Grievance Advisory Committee setup for handling disputes with the shelters. And I wonder if you can tell me whether what you've done already this morning has resulted in any changed attitude toward that grievance policy, or whether it's adequate, or how it can help reduce homelessness if it was revised. And according to your answer, I will address the situation as it is. What you've done, anything this morning, have you changed or modified or amended your shelter grievance policy?
So we had a few discussions this morning already about the shelter grievance policy. We don't have the time to recount, unfortunately.
Did you have any significant change?
No.
No.
No, not at this time.
All right. Yes, then I need to tell you that I am taking issue with it. And when I found myself blasted out or kidnapped out of sanctuary shelter by an arbitrary action that could not, in my view, be solved by your grievance policy, I have simply not accepted it, but I have not been silent. I have made a request for an administrative hearing, a fair administrative hearing with oral evidence, which this your policy now doesn't permit this. And I served it timely within 3 days of the time I was given a DOS from Sanctuary Shelter. I've also served it not only on the shelter director within 3 days, but I have served it on Human Services and the Health Department, too. And I have not gotten an answer. I'm on the verge of going outside the city for lack of a response to my reasonable request for a fair administrative hearing with oral evidence. None of those agencies, and then it's gone to the new department, too, by this kind of service that I gave. I would like to have an answer. If you think that it's worthy of an answer, I would appreciate your requiring some adequate material response to what I've had. Not just heckling, but something of the request for fair administrative hearing is 3 pages long. The first is the request for the hearing, and the second page is...
Excuse me, ma'am. Unfortunately, your time is up for public comment.
Could I send an immediate denial of service notice so you have the denial of service to look at, and also a page that summarizes administrative agencies in relation to civil rights, having fair hearings. We do not have a fair hearing by a neutral agency. And the state has a fair hearing department.
Your time is up, Mayor. Thank you very much.
I just wanted to say I'm so sorry for your frustration. It sounds overwhelming. I'm relatively new, but I'll inquire as to the barriers to your hearing.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you again.
Now, could I have a response from this agency whether they would like to undertake something that what I'm asking, so that we can get on with it within San Francisco? Otherwise, I've gone to the Board of Supervisors and told them that this policy that you have needs amending. And so I might take exhausted remedy unless I get something positive that we're gonna look at it. We want a few certain number of days to do it, and we will respond one way or another. Either we're going to give you a hearing or we're not, but we're not just going to be dead end, you know, that you can't even talk.
Your public comment is up, and you know, you can always write us a letter or request.
I have already written to you.
Ma'am, I've never gotten a letter from you.
No, you haven't gotten a personal letter, but I have.
Ma'am, let me say again. You can write us a letter.
You can request
to be on a later agenda, and we can deal with it.
You can't
but right
deal
now,
with
your time
mayor.
Is up, ma'am.
I'm sorry.
Ma'am, your time is up.
Been kidnapped and my property taken without accountability.
Ma'am, I'm going to ask you to respect this board. Your time is up. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Would somebody inquire whether what I have already served has failed to get to you, not by my fault, but because they didn't bring it to your attention.
Again, ma'am, I ask you to respect the board and this audience here. We only have a certain amount of time, but we can't give you 18 minutes to give someone else 2 minutes. I'm sorry, ma'am.
If this is your answer, that the people are asking for fairness and justice and reduction of homelessness have to have 2 minutes or they're not listened to, that answers why we have so much homelessness.
This meeting is run by the Rules Committee, ma'am. We have to stay by.
I hope somebody, before I leave this will tell me that you will take.
All right, so we're going to move to the last agenda item.
Public comment.
She is definitely making reference to the safe housing that they're going to put into with no accountability for the criminals that the city and county of San Francisco contracts to. So the city contracts out to criminals who run these shelters, and then they don't get a grievance process. That's their safe locations. All right. I guess my question is why does the city, and why won't they put toilets or trash cans in these encampments so that it can at least reduce what the neighbors are saying? I want to see documentation on how the city actually tracks whoever is interacting with these teams. I just keep paralleling this to Prop Q, and I'm thinking they safe housing, in theory, anecdotally, like the guy is saying, they can dump somebody in a one-night bed after taking them out of an encampment, and then after they've lost most or half of their stuff, then they can just dump them back out on the street. And we don't have any type of, he hasn't housed anybody, nobody from this month. Nobody in no housing, that's what he's saying. I mean, are they even trying? Are they just pushing people around? And let me remind you, Luis Angora. The high team called the police on Luis Angora. They did this gang violence on this guy. They jumped out their cars and just shot him dead. And is that how you think of the homeless, that we can just call the police on him and the police will come and shoot him dead and we just it's only cool? I mean, I'm wondering what training has this homeless encampment team even had? I mean, we're being victimized by codified, institutionalized violence. And these people, they make big money off of this.
Thank you for your comment.
And you can be crass, but we can go look at your sample.
All right, we'll move on to the final agenda item. It's the home base and the Center for Common Concerns update.
Thank you. This is going to take less than 30 seconds. And if you have questions, please let me know. Just brought the Warriors colored paper for you. It's an update from something we dealt with last month. And it's good news in the sense that the HUD went back and looked at the San Francisco Continuum of Care score in the last competition and raised it by 12 points. So that's very good news. That resulted in another project being funded for a total of $362,764. That was Mercy Housing's 95 Laguna Senior Housing, and that will bring another project into our community.
Good. That was a missing mine from last month, right?
Yes. Correct. It was the mystery project.
Right.
So we have resolved that.
Good news, thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. So we'll open it to public comments. Explicitly around the update from home base. If no public comment, then we'll open it to a general public comment.
So the safety, I've been followed twice on the streets. It kind of sucks when you have to check into the shelters and no weapon policy, but I like to carry around pepper spray. Because I'm always getting hit on, especially along Market Street. And I feel a lot better with some protection and, you know, at least leave it in the office and then pick it up in the morning when you step out or something, you know. The pepper spray, I'm a single mom with one child. I don't have no man, okay? So I'm just out here by myself, no family. So I would like that kind of protection. Another thing, when I wake up and I'm out and I'm going down from Steiner, that was 50, that's Oak. Oh yeah, all the way Oak to Market, and there's a lot of truck use going on. I'm always trying to show my child what the little poison part, because there's people in the little cracks, you know, trying to shield up and stuff. So it's real disturbing. And when I want to go to St. Anthony's or go to my store to go to Clyde for breakfast, there's dirt on the floor and syringes too. So I don't want my child to see that. But that's just one of the things that I see on a daily basis. But I do appreciate the Tenderloin team making come around and try to get that stuff up. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'd like to talk about the physical effects that it has on the child and the parent. So since I've been homeless for 2 years, I suffer with a virus that's in my stomach that can turn into cancer. So I've been treated 3 or 4 times. Sometimes it goes away, then it comes right back. So I'm not eating appropriately, you know, because I'm staying in a room. I have nowhere to cook. Every time I go to my godmother's every blue moon, but then I have to let my food sit, and then so that's what they're telling me. So, and then I suffer from dual diagnosis too. So, and one of my daughters was my autistic, so I couldn't have my kids with me while I was homeless. So I preferred for them to be somewhere where they were safe, they wouldn't go through the smoothie stuff, and they wouldn't go through, you know, having problems at school. Because when I was staying at Hamilton, my kids, even though I stayed in the shelter, my kids wanted to know when were we going to get our own place. Mom, when were we going to get our own place? So I'm just saying that it has a lot of effect on the children. And for me, I didn't want to take my children through that, and then I knew that I was going through stuff. So it does have a lot of effect on the children, and especially if you're not going to the doctors on a regular basis. Our dogs have a doctor that you have been seeing. So to find out, to do a regular checkup, to see what was going on with you, and you'll find out at the end. Like most, like a lot of people, sometimes when they go through all this stuff, and they end up getting a place, for 2 or 3 months down the line, they end up passing. You know, so, you know, and I've had a lot of friends that have went through that experience. So that's what I'm going to tell.
And I'm going to ask that this be the last person public comment. You know, our rules committee only allows us to be here for 2 hours. So, but I'll give you a remedy, a way to make public comment either via our email, our fax, or just U.S. mail. If you have any comments after this, thank you.
After me, or?
No,
okay,
be the last
thank
person.
You. Yeah, just really quick. I just realized there was a couple of things that I hadn't, like, brought up before. I'm going to let this be before him. It'll distract me. Okay. So just about family involvement in these meetings, I know that I specifically in the meetings am the only one who has experienced homelessness with their child, has experienced homelessness with their child and been through domestic violence, has kids in elementary school. So just again, I just really want to stress how important it is to have more than just me, because a lot of the times people tend to ignore my voice and push my voice aside, which I've witnessed that firsthand, and I have to bring that to the families. And so, just so that everyone in this room can understand where I'm coming from and where the other families are coming from when these policies are just pushed on them. Also, looking at what happened in Kings County in Seattle around family homelessness and the coordinated entry system, by making eligibility and priority so hard to attain, they ended up realizing after 2014 that it was really affecting the people who did not qualify. Within 2 years, those who did not qualify for priority were so needy that they then fell into that category. And we really want to catch those families before they even get to that most needy category. You see what I'm saying? Like, either in housing or in shelter. Because originally it was that these families would be eligible for diversion, whatever that is. Oops, sorry. Now we're being told, you know, we're not really sure what diversion is. They might not be. So that, and then I also want to touch base on safe places that we were saying people from encampments were getting placed at. We have to remember that people who have been through trauma and people who are in the street, what is a safe place to you is not a safe place to me. And so we cannot judge people, and we have to give people options, because like being in a certain neighborhood might not be safe for me. Being around certain people might not be safe for me. Being in an enclosed space might not be safe for me. So just a reminder that everybody's been through a lot of trauma.
Thank you. So we're going to move towards adjournment. And I'll give you the methods to make a public comment in either those ways, or you can go to the next meeting. Because we're limited by the Rules Committee to 11 or 1 o'clock, and we're way over now. Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Mr. President Rhodes, can I make a comment?
No, you're going to make it next time. We got to hear the word. We're way over right now. Thank you, sir.
You want to move on, Chair?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
So, please, Mr. Chairman.
I have a general comment. I talked on the agenda item that I would like to have a minute or two.
Well, our meeting is adjourned, ma'am.
What?
Our meeting is adjourned. Thank you, folks, for coming. I hope to see you next month. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, young lady. Oh, it's always.
Hold on. Let me get this. I'm listening. I just got to turn off.
I'm buying it with the SF help. Really quick. Something that's